Are you interested in a life in ministry?
Are you passionate about the church and how it functions?
Do you not get enough of listening to pastors on Sundays? Well, you're in the right place. This is Under the Fig Tree, a podcast for people who are interested in church work. I'm Ben.
And I'm Micah. We are two pastors who work at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. Join us as we dive into the vocation of pastoral ministry, dig into scripture, and occasionally talk about other stuff, like our unquestionable love for the Dallas Cowboys.
And of course, we'll be talking about Star Wars. We'll talk to guests about doctrine, traditions, and what makes someone a good candidate for the pastoral office, besides being called by God. And we may just help you figure out if this pastor or deaconess stuff is for you.
Again, this is Under the Fig Tree from Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. What's up, what's up, what's up? Once again, welcome back to another episode of Under the Fig Tree. I'm your host, Reverend Micah Glenn, Director of Recruitment here at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. And I'm, of course, joined by my co-host. You know, co-host, there's an Office episode about this. Nonetheless, before I get too distracted, my co-host, the Reverend Dr. Ben Haupt, the Associate Provost. What's going on, Ben?
Hey, good to be with you, and good to be on another episode of Under the Fig Tree. Lots of good stuff happening at Concordia Seminary. The spring has finally sprung, and we got students sitting outside and soaking up the sun, enjoying good conversation, and yeah, life is good.
I definitely stood on my porch for about 2.5 minutes just to get that vitamin D. Now that it's available, you know, these natural resources, I just try to enjoy it when I can. You know, it's no longer gloomy. It's no longer below 30 degrees. Life is okay.
It is indeed. And we're super excited. We have a special guest with us today.
Yep. I always knew him as the best, maybe historically best dressed faculty member at Concordia Seminary, Reverend Dr. Herman Eric. How are you, brother?
Good to be here. How are you all doing today?
Good. Well, I can't complain. You know, just one day at a time, trying to get things shaking and moving for recruiting, this podcast included. Yeah.
Dr. Hey, Herman, I agree with you all. The spring is upon us, and it's a lovely time to be outside as we can make it.
Soon the days will get longer, which will be nice, so that when we're done with work, we can actually enjoy a little bit of outdoor time ourselves as well. My kids, of course, love the Concordia Seminary campus, and so getting to run around with them and then picking up all the random sticks that they can and trying to bring them back into the house is always a fun challenge.
I realize that all three of us share something in common, and that's it's house 9.
That's right.
We all lived in house 9, not all at the same time. But house 9 on campus, the famed Franzmann house.
Yeah, Martin Franzmann's house.
Once upon a time.
Evidently where he wrote Thy Strong Word. And,
look at that, that's right.
They let the riffraff come in and live in after him. So,
right. I could be close to the spot.
That's right. Yeah, coming to us from the office. Dr. Herman, a lot of times in the beginning of our episodes, we talk a little bit about what we're into, what we're watching, what we're kind of just enjoying in life when we're not studying theology. So have there been any good shows, or what do you do to entertain yourself at the Herman household?
Yeah, well, in terms of shows, we tend to watch stuff that the kids can watch with us. And it's always some form of binge watching of stuff that everybody else has seen already. And finally, the Hermans are getting to it. I think we're watching Chuck, which is a kind of a spoof CIA sort of thing, and we like detective stuff, but usually stuff that doesn't make us think too hard. So this spring's been nice. We've for all the weirdness that this year has been, we've had a pretty good time as a family, and I'm not teaching anything this first half semester, so that gives me a little time to do some extra writing and reading even outside of my field. So
nice.
So that's been nice. My department chair has been good to me and let me off for a half a semester.
For those who don't know, Dr. Herman, we'll just call you Eric from now on.
That sounds better. Great.
Yeah. What do you teach here at CSL?
So I teach church history, and mostly kind of 16th century Reformation, Luther stuff, and back. So I'll teach some medieval and some early church. I've kind of settled on Augustine as my go-to for an early church class. And then every once in a while, I'll teach something in another department just to keep things interesting. So actually, they have me teaching homiletics next year, so we'll see how that goes. But yeah, for the most part, I teach church history, and ref stuff is my area.
You know, I had the pleasure of taking Reformation history, not here, but when I was studying at Westfield House.
Oh, sure.
And, you know, the different perspective was, I found it to be kind of refreshing, because here it's always, not in a negative sense, Luther, 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 and that's kind of what dominates Reformation history. But he was just a lecturer of the 12 or 16 that we received for the course. So, yeah, learning about different reformers at the time and hearing their contributions or lack thereof, well, it was just good. I thought it was, again, just a little refreshing.
Yeah, the Reformation is bigger than just what's happening in Germany with Luther. There's, you know, English ref and French ref. And, yeah.
Well, in the English ref, I also took that was a completely separate class. Man, what a mind trap the English Reformation was.
Yeah, it is. You think watching Meghan Markle interviews and stuff is dramatic now. I mean, back then it was crazy. Who did you have over in Westfield House or over at Cambridge?
Oh, yeah. At the faculty was Richard Rex.
Yeah, I had him too.
For both Reformation courses. So there was, when we were doing Luther, and he knew the Lutheran students, he was like, Luther, I'll never forget this quote. He said, Luther would say works are futile. I challenge anybody to refute me. And he looked over at us. I was like, I want to refute you, but like, I feel like you're prepared and I'm not.
That's right.
I didn't fall for the trap. But he was a great lecturer though, for sure.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. That's cool.
His book is The Stripping of the Altars.
Edmund Duffy.
Edmund Duffy. There we go. Yeah. We read a lot of him. And so, yeah, it's just different reading. And then going back to Westfield House and trying to digest it all in a Lutheran way. It was just good training. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, after you have a couple Roman Catholics lecture to you about the significance of the Reformation, it's good to go back to Westfield and think about what Lutherans think about this.
Yeah. And so that was another thing. One more thing on Richard Rex while we're talking about him. He challenged anybody to figure out what, you know, tradition he belonged to. I always assumed he was a Roman Catholic based upon his attitude. And I think you just confirmed that. And somebody was trying to tell me he was Anglican. I was like, I don't think so.
When I was there, we had one more. Peter Newman Brooks was kind of the famous lecturer over there.
Okay.
And when he was leaving, he was all angry that they weren't going to replace him with another Protestant, that the history department is being taken over by papists, as he said. But they all got along pretty well.
Yeah. Good stuff.
Excellent. Well, I know we want to dive into the topic of a theology of humor, of laughter, of mirth. You'll probably define what mirth is for our listeners that may not know that word. And I think you have some colorful stories that you might share as well, and maybe even take us into some real life examples of this Reformation stuff that we've been talking about. So
yeah.
Tell us a little bit about what you've been thinking about.
Well, you know, I'm a Luther guy, and one of the things that makes Luther fun to read. I mean, he's a brilliant theologian, and of course, a great pious preacher. But if anyone's read Luther for any length, they've realized how kind of entertaining he can be. He has quite a sharp sense of humor. He can throw out some of the nastiest insults in the 16th century that ever went out, and you know, I mean, here's a period of time where there's no indoor plumbing, and even in that context, Luther's considered dirty. So it's So that's always been sort of fun, but also it's been a bit of a scandal for some people. And there's been a little work done actually on what Luther's doing when he's cracking jokes, or the kinds of insults that he's, you know, using satire and whatnot. And, you know, this is a period of time where you don't have, apart from court jesters, you don't have professional comedians. So humor and comedy, first of all, has different meanings back then and what it's trying to do. But one of the things that I teach a course on Luther as pastor, and I have a unit just on how Luther uses humor as an aspect of pastoral care or as an expression of his faith. And that, it helps us understand a little bit what's going on there. But even bigger than that is, you know, here we are at seminary and we're doing theology. And that's, of course, a very serious subject. But the tendency for us here, and actually for all people, is to take themselves far too seriously. And the relationship of being proud or arrogant and not having a sense of humor is actually, I mean, you've all met people that clearly just don't seem to have a sense of humor. And they are usually sort of full of themselves, too, at the same time.
Yeah.
You have to be able to laugh at yourself. There's a certain sense in which life requires, if you've ever lived in this world and paid attention long enough, it requires some kind of self-deprecation. And and otherwise, you know, if you don't laugh, you're going to cry. And a lot of that's at play, too, in Luther's thought. And in others too. Maybe I'll share a couple other quotes too today. Maybe with from C.S. Lewis, who is I think one of the more important modern theologians that focuses on the positive, delightful side of theology without giving up its, you know, heavy weight and seriousness.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. The first time that I read some of Luther as a very pious, probably trying too hard, a young seminarian, I was kind of put off by some of Luther's wit and even just, you know, foul language or whatever, or even kind of some of the things that he said is just mean-spirited. But the person that I studied in my dissertation to do a little bit more historical theology was Tertullian, who also has this reputation for saying just really mean things or saying things that are kind of so tongue-in-cheek that they're kind of problematic sometimes theologically. And I was talking with our colleague Joel Olowski, who's recently been in touch with some battle rappers down in Texas, and battle.
Joel Olowski is in touch with all sorts of weird people. That's a
fascinating guy, right? So the culture of battle rap, this whole idea is that you're kind of trying to get a rise out of the crowd and to get a rise out of the person that you're battling in rap. And I suggested that, you know, there also has been some work done on Tertullian and kind of what he's trying to do and how he's trying to, I think, in an oral society in which the spoken word was tremendously important and tremendously entertaining, that they were getting a rise out of their audience and keeping their audience awake and interested. So I don't know that I'm going to throw down a bunch of foul language here, but hopefully our listeners are tracking along. And yeah, I think that there's something to be said for people in different ages who are trying to do things with their words to keep people engaged and pulled in. So I don't know if it's the exact same thing that was going on with Luther, but I'm interested to hear a little bit more. What was Luther up to with his language, with his humor?
Well, and remember, in Luther's day, we're just really starting to shift heavily into print. So we're moving away from orality. And what does it mean to use rhetorical use of humor in writing? And one thing that's worth clarifying is that Luther can sound mean, but often his sharpest remarks are not against helpless people or people. Mm-hmm. They're against colleagues, people who, from his perspective, have a responsibility and should know better, right? And therefore should be able to take it. I always, there's a very nice piece written on how Luther dealt with his students, and the way in which he approaches his students is very, very different than the way he deals with others in his writings. In fact, it said that Philip Melanchthon, his colleague, who's often known as this sort of quiet, soft-spoken fella in theology, he was a shark when it came to tearing down his students who made mistakes and whatnot. And Luther would just sort of help them out. They're in a debate or a disputation, and Luther would be like, "Don't you mean you meant to say this sort of thing?" And so he has a pastoral sense, and I think one thing we shouldn't leave away with is that Luther gives us license to just sort of be mean or be jerks. And I mean, I think Luther acknowledges that he's done that at times, but that's not kind of what's sitting behind this. So yeah, with that, one other point is he said that in his day, the church in his day punished heresy by burning them at the stake. And he just called heretics jackasses. So putting it in perspective, he's a little bit of the more softer approach to this problem.
Fair enough.
So, yeah, what I thought I'd do is share a little bit. Psalm 100 was a psalm that I used to consider this a little bit more closely. The psalms in general are filled with all sorts of psalms of joy and delight and laughter and singing, as well as the other side of lament and sorrow, et cetera. Psalm 100 talks about praising the Lord for his goodness. And I really like this, you know, that the Calvinists did a lot of work in rephrasing and paraphrasing the Psalter so they could sing it like chorale hymns. And one of the Scottish paraphrases, I think from early 17th century on Psalm 100, the first stanza translates, "Serve the Lord with gladness," with instead, "Him serve with mirth," which touches on both not just happiness and joy, but also I think just absolute delight and the kind of thing that you would burst out laughing over, right? Mm. So I'll just read the first stanza. "All people that on earth do dwell, sing to the Lord with cheerful voice. Him serve with mirth, his praise forth tell. Come ye before him and rejoice." I think recognizing that the divine scriptures are filled with this kind of overflowing mirth and joy gives us permission to think about this a little bit more closely. One of the things that before kind of entering into it, looking at humor and wit and joy in Luther's day, is what I mentioned earlier, that humor, the word humor, and even the word comedy had a very different meaning in Luther's day and in the Middle Ages. You've all heard of Dante's Divine Comedy. Probably were forced to read it, if not enjoyed it, at least at some point. It's when you start reading it, if you just pay attention to the title and you think, oh, good, this is going to be a lot of fun. And then you find yourself literally in purgatory. and there's no jokes, nothing going on. So why is this thing called a comedy, of course? And the reason is because the word comedy is at that time means about a poem or a narrative that has a twist. There's maybe a tragedy or a turmoil, but actually ends up with a triumph at the end. And so Dante is taking a course from, you know, through hell into purgatory, and then it finally ends with the beatific vision of God in the end of heaven. So it's a comedy in that sense, which is important, I think. This actually is key to understanding how Luther's humor, or how any humor, can work theologically. It lives on that turn of victory and triumph over tragedy. That's where it can actually function pastorally. So that would be sort of one point worth making. The other is that humor also went through a couple of different phases. Humor was originally just definition for different bodily fluids that determined your mood. So you had four basic fluids: melancholy, you know, black bile, yellow bile, blood, and if you had an imbalance of that, then you had a certain kind of mood. If you were melancholy, you had too much black bile, which I get when I eat Mexican food, I think. But melancholy meant you were sort of, you took yourself too seriously, and you sort of were listless then and depressed. And if you've read anything about Luther early on, I mean, and even throughout his life, he had these bouts of melancholy and depression. And one way to interact with that is to counter that humor with something, you know, kind of directly opposite it, you know, go after it. Instead of taking something deadly seriously, and maybe the seriousness is his own own excommunication or whatever it is, temptations of the devil. It's in that moment that he might actually crack a joke, and he does it to diminish the seriousness of the moment, to show that there's something actually more serious that can cause him to laugh.
Mm. Which is exactly what they do on every good television episode now, right? Where after you deliver some super serious line, at least this is what they did in Friends in The Office, you have a super serious moment where the viewer learns something, and then Chandler Bing's going to come in and crack a joke, and everything's going to kind of settle out a little bit, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It doesn't. And it actually, it eases tensions and opens things up. I mean, when Luther writes letters to people who are depressed, and there's an enormous amount of letters where he writes to people who have anxiety and are in doubt, and he gives them advice that any practical counselor would recognize as good advice, which is be in the room with other people. Don't be by yourself. Laugh. Crack jokes, sing songs, and fun songs, not, you know, the Lenten songs that we're all singing right now. And then he'll just say even more absurd things, like if the devil's haunting you, then my method is to follow what my pastor does, which is fart at him, right? Flatulence as a method for dealing. Well, does Luther not take the devil seriously? Of course, the devil is, I think, in the catechism, the word devil is mentioned more than any other word in the catechism. And because it's such a serious issue for Luther, I mean, he has a real sense of the battle that's going on. Mighty Fortress is all about the world filled with devils. And that, nevertheless, you hold on to the victory. And in that context, Luther can look at the seriousness of the devil and say, but the resurrection of Christ is more serious. And so, so powerful that I actually can take you very lightly and laugh at you, you know. So that would be sort of the first level of things, and it sort of explains, it's not really self-deprecation or taking yourself lightly. It's taking the things that oppose you lightly because you take Christ so seriously. That comes out kind of over and over again, even in his writings to his students. You know, how do you deal with this? I'm a sinner, but Christ is a bigger savior. So here you go. Mm.
You know, my first encounters with Luther's humor, I was always taken aback because, you know, I had my German grandmother. She's now deceased. And then also just from other people telling me that Germans are very serious people. They're very, you know, staunch and all these other things, which, like, I've met actual people from Germany and they don't model anything that I was told about Germanness growing up. But I was always taken aback because, again, my image of German people, especially in Luther's day, was just the photos, the pictures, just this real serious dude
who's
always always taking things overly serious. And then you read this stuff and it's a breath of fresh air. It kind of more humanizes people that you have a different opinion about, which in my mind can only be a good thing, especially when you're considering your pastor and just realizing that he's just a dude. Like the three of us, you know, three, mm-hmm. two faculty members, one staff member of CSL talking about, you know, poop. Everybody does this.
Everybody does it. So here's a few quotes that we all love of Luther here. So here's a great one. He says, "When I resist the devil, and often it is with a fart that I chase him away. When he tempts me with silly sins, I say, 'Devil, yesterday I broke wind too. Do you have that written down on your list?'" And so again, if you're going to bring up all this stuff about my past, I'll just add to it and just, you know, keep on writing. And, you know, what's interesting when I would look at C.S. Lewis, of course, famously wrote the Screwtape Letters, which is the devil's perspective on Christian life. So it's everything is flipped and everything is opposite in the Screwtape Letters.
Oh, yeah.
But he has a whole chapter or an entire letter dedicated to laughter. And there, Screwtape says that he divides the causes of human laughter into joy, fun, the joke proper, and then flippancy. And he says the problem with laughter and jokes is you can always try to twist them to hurt people's feelings or whatever, but you have to be very careful because it's actually, you're messing with something that comes from God. It's not properly ours, right? The only thing that's really in our camp is flippancy, he says, the things that sort of dismissive of God. And of course, when Luther flips that around and does flippancy to the devil, that's the most painful approach. So I think the people that sort of specialize in joy and humor and delight also recognize that it's one of the most dangerous things to diabolical temptation. The devil actually is far too serious.
Well, and if you think both about Luther and about Lewis, I mean, here's two guys that lived through just tremendously traumatic episodes in human history, right? I mean, Luther himself is living through the Black Plague. Some of my favorite stuff of reading Luther is when he's talking about, you know, I will stay and I'm going to stay in Wittenberg as the plague rages on. Mm-hmm. And Lewis, of course, lives through World War II, and that had such a profound, well, and World War I had such a profound impact on him. So both of those guys lived through crazy times, and here we are pushing through this pandemic. It's high time that we have a little bit of humor this crazy year that we've all had. And it's been very, very difficult for a lot of people, for sure.
No, that's right. And it's not, again, you can't sort of take those things lightly, flippantly, and look at them and say that these haven't really deeply affected people. On the other hand, you know, Luther, of course, you said living in a time, he looks around and he says, as much as Luther can talk about the devil, he has this great line in the book of Genesis, where his lectures on Genesis, where he says, if you just take stock of things, you realize how little the devil actually controls. And so we have in front of us, of course, the constant stream of the news, which, you know, makes its bread and butter on not highlighting the 95% of good things that are happening from day to day, but these, you know, the tragic things and the fearful things that are happening. And I don't blame the news necessarily for this. This is not an opportunity to go crashing down on the media or something like that. But we tend as a people tend to zero in on only the things that trouble us or worry us when we don't have a broad enough perspective on how beautiful and wonderful life generally is for most people. I mean, it's a miracle, given how I am and how, you know, normal people are, that we don't kill each other every day. I mean, just sitting there in the grocery store, I mean, good grief. Somehow we all restrain ourselves. And then I don't go home and say, wow, I made it to the grocery store with a bunch of people that probably should hate me and I hate them, and none of us died. And I don't give thanks to God for that or laugh or any of those things. And we should be. It's remarkable that the world is the way it is. I think this is it gives us a broader perspective. And humor requires you to decenter from everything that's sort of focused on yourself and start kind of gazing more widely. The funniest comedians, of course, are those that are observational comedians, those who look at the world, not at themselves as much, but look at the world from a new set of angles and point out, what is it that Homer Simpson always says? It's funny because it's true, right?
Yeah.
Well, there's something to that. The court jester in the Middle Ages and in Luther's day, they were given impunity. They were given permission to say the truth, no matter how painfully it hurt, without punishment, right? They could call courtiers ugly, and they could point out. And a lot of the humor was political too. They would, and then sometimes the court jester was the only one that could give bad news. Mm. I think it was, what was it, was it to Henry VIII, or maybe it was even a little earlier, where the court jester had to give to the King of England the bad news that they had lost a battle, a sea battle with the French. And he gave it this way. He said that the French are a bunch of cowards and didn't jump in the ocean like the brave English. And so from that line, you realize, oh gosh, our boat sank. But humor is a way of actually as truth telling. And, we look at the prophets in the Old Testament. Some of the great moments of the prophets is when they flip this ironic shift, right? Where you have the Nathan and David, he's telling this poignant story. And if it wasn't such a powerful, damning story, you'd realize the inherent humor in flipping what you thought was a person I'm after. It now is, I'm actually been condemning myself this whole time. So it works on the same logic. Sometimes it ends in repentance and sometimes it ends in consolation. But what else? Another thought bringing out there in terms of humor, and this is jumping ahead now to the 20th century, you mentioned Lewis living through a terrible time. I just finished reading a biography by Alan Jacobs on C.S. Lewis. It's called The Narnian. Hmm. And probably one of the best biographies of Lewis I've read. I mean, it weaves in and out of his literary production while trying to explain the way his life unfolds. But he's got this really interesting reflection on Lewis's character kind of before and after conversion. He writes, he's read all of his letters, of course, in preparation for this biography, and he's read a lot of his writings. And he says, the most dominant feeling I get, this is Alan Jacobs talking, when I read C.S. Lewis's early letters, that is those written in his first 30 years of life, is that in none of them does he sound like himself. The pre-conversion Lewis is, though obviously highly intelligent, neither a particularly likable nor a particularly interesting person, at least in his letters. He may have been delightful to know, though I doubt it. But once he admitted that God was God, it is as though the key to his own hidden and locked away personality was given to him. Mm. What appears almost immediately is a kind of gusto, sheer, bold enthusiasm for what he loves that is characteristic of him ever after. And then he shares this really interesting anecdote where in the London newspaper, the Daily Telegraph did a story on Lewis in 1944, and the writer referred to Lewis at one point as ascetic Mr. Lewis. And when Tolkien read this, he spluttered with incredulity and indignation, and he wrote to his son, ascetic Mr. Lewis, I ask you, he put away 3 pints in a very short session we had this morning and said he was going short for Lent. So Lewis is this other guy who's just his theology is full of it, not humor and the kinds of stuff that make you giggle or laugh, but as one writer said after reading his whole work, and he was a student of his, an atheist actually, Kenneth Tynan, who's was a famous playwright and critic, but he actually studied under Lewis at Oxford. And after he finished reading, one of the Narnia books, he says, "How thrilling he makes goodness seem, how tangible and how radiant." That seems like that's the Christian vocation, right? I mean, that's the calling of the church. If we can make goodness, life with God, that people on the outside look at it and say, how thrilling it must be to be in fellowship with the creator of heaven and earth. How radiant, how joyful. And then you realize that humor and delight and mirth is has to be there if you believe this stuff.
Well, people, you know, I think from an outside perspective looking in, what people see is usually the rules, especially like the practical rules. You sit still, you keep your hands folded in your lap, you keep your face stony. When you go to the Lord's Supper or on your way back to your pew, you know, you look like something serious just happened. I mean, I'm usually wrangling my kids and trying not to trip over them, laughing at, you know, something preposterous that one of my children did at the rail, you know. But you know, from an outsider perspective looking in, exactly, when we look so droll and just kind of robotic, it doesn't look very interesting and it doesn't look very appealing. But especially when you look through the Psalter, you know, the Psalms in particular, they're filled with emotion, high, low, they're real. And I think you've hit the nail on the head. If we brought that aspect of the Christian life, one that I find particularly freeing, as opposed to, you know, restricting, just by nature of who we are, our identity as Christians that way, I think would appeal to more people who don't yet know Jesus. It would just living like we have salvation, right? Yeah, which is a lot of what Luther is getting at with his fart humor. You know, I'm free. I'll fart in your face, devil. Get behind me.
No, that's right. I think that you know, Lutherans in particular are good at like vultures sort of waiting for the bad thing to happen and then come swooping in with the good news of the gospel. In other words, the way in which we think of evangelism or sharing the good news is always on the far side of an experience of the law. And I'm not saying that's incorrect. I mean, ultimately, even Lewis, who sort of on one hand can describe his conversion to Christianity as being surprised by joy, in which the beautiful things of life pointed finally to the thing that gave it meaning. Still had to come to terms with his own sin, right? And so that dynamic is there. But I think that's not the only way in which God's goodness and that we can point to it is through the opposite. I think we can actually present and I think it's really important in a world in which actually, because of technology and science and you know, God-given reason, there's actually a lot to celebrate too. To be able to point to those things rather than diminish them and not make idols out of them, but see them, put them in their proper perspective, that they're actually can point us to a God. They say the atheist has the toughest time on Thanksgiving because he has no one to thank. Well, that's not because of the bad stuff in life. It's because of the overwhelming good stuff in life. And wouldn't it be great if we could finally meet the person who gave this to us, right?
Right.
Yeah, there's a great line from Andrew Peterson, who's this kind of singer-songwriter, lives in Nashville, hangs with some of this Presbyterian crowd, but kind of PCA folks. But he's got a line in one of his songs where he says, "Don't you want to thank someone? Don't you just want to thank someone for this?" And he's talking about all of creation. So, yeah, there is a time where it's just great to be able to say, "Wow, life does have these moments where goodness breaks in, or laughter, hilarity, a wonderful evening with friends," and to be able to just say, "Wow, This is part of the human experience because God intended it this way. Well, I want to shift the conversation a little bit because this is under the fig tree, and we're specifically thinking about people who are perhaps considering coming to seminary, considering studying theology, and they might be wondering, well, how does this kind of play out at the seminary? Because the seminary can maybe sometimes be characterized, or sometimes people kind of imagine what goes on at the seminary. Is it this tragically serious place where everybody is just nose in the book? And we're all about being in the books, but how does this all play out in the life of a seminarian or in the life of studying theology? Because I see lots of examples, or a lot of examples come to my mind about how this actually plays out in real concrete life at the seminary, but interested to hear your thoughts on what does this look like in the classroom, outside of the classroom?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's one of the great gifts of Christian fellowship in general, and then, the seminary education in residence. When you can all be here, and in which what you learn ends up not sort of just staying between you and the book and the professor, but ends up becoming kind of fills your conversation. And that doesn't mean that everything is that people on the walkways or at lunch are just talking about theology in the same seriousness with which the German translation of Wiener Schnitzel or whoever it is that you just read takes it. But it actually, you end up, I mean, I remember one of the first things that happened when I was here, I had a tour as I visited the seminary. Someone gave me a tour and he started cracking jokes on his tour, but they were all like nerdy theology jokes. They weren't funny yes. to me at all. You know, he was going on about like,
they're laughing at us, not with us.
And like how, you know, one fountain was low, and so it's a subordinationist Arian view of the Trinity today. And I was just like, what? What is he? But of course, he's just giggling, and they probably had this joke among themselves. And so on the one hand, yeah, I mean, we're all geeking out about this stuff. But geeking out means, you know, you've really enjoyed it. You've actually found a delight in the thing, and you can actually crack jokes about it and make it part of your living conversation. And every discipline has that. When somebody finally enters into something that has real joy for them, then you what? You geek out, right? And there's a lot of geeking out over here as well. So I think that's one thing. It's pretty important. I think the other thing is just the vocation itself. We know that on the one hand, the call of a pastor isn't to always make someone feel better. Consolation isn't necessarily always about that. What our primary goal as pastors is that people will have faith. And sometimes to have faith means receiving a hard word rather than a comforting word. But we know the goal, right? We know where all of this is leading. We've been given a glimpse of the end game in the resurrection of Jesus, and it's absolutely delightful, right? It's the thing that we were made to be, and so that vocation itself, while it can be really there's burdens that pastors have to bear, and along with everybody else in the Christian church, knowing the outcome of things lets you hold on to those tragedies and those sufferings just a little more lightly. You know, it's like when you know the end of a game because you heard it on the radio on the way home before you got to watch it on TiVo. Do they even have TiVo now anymore? Anyway, so but then when you watch the game, every fumble, every turnover, none of that stuff freaks you out because you know where it's going to end up, even though you don't know exactly how each one of these moves is going to play out. And that's kind of where we are. We are in a position of being able to know that even the greatest tragedies that our people will experience, those aren't the last words, but rather a word of joy.
I think too about just I love that. I think too about the the other people that we study theology with. You mentioned Lewis and Tolkien, and they're ribbing each other about how much beer one had had at the last meetup of the Inklings. And I know that Dr. Herman, you've talked a little bit about in Lord of the Rings, the friendship between Sam and Frodo, that there is this there's this great joy in just having good friends. And seminary is an amazing place to just be able to sit around with friends and talk some theology, talk about what was discussed in class, but also just talk about life, talk about faith, talk about what's going on in the world, but to make some amazing friends that you can that really those friendships are things that will continue on in life. And a lot of times people come away from seminary with this amazing friend network that really helps them to transition to their first parish. And even when difficulties come, to have some group that they can always go back to say, here's what I'm wrestling with personally or pastorally. Here's, do you have some advice? Or there's just something awesome about being able to sit around with friends and spend this time at seminary together.
Not that long out of graduating from seminary, coming up on 5 years, man. Feels weird, but at the same time, it's really not that long at all. But like, so me and my friends, we weren't the first, but I feel like we normalized being at CSL for 5 years to the point where we were called the 5-year mafia just because the group was so large. And we do a monthly Zoom, and there's a significant portion where we laugh at the boneheaded things that we did or said at seminary. Like, you're, again, like you said earlier, you come in, you're a hotshot theologian, seminary student. I wasn't. And I tried to fit in. I was a chemist when I first got to seminary, and I was very ignorant towards a lot of things. And so many times I opened my mouth and blundered. I'll say it. I'm totally ashamed of this, by the way, so you can judge me. It's okay. But we were looking at, it was in Hom 1, Learning How to Preach, and we're looking at Genesis 18 and Abraham's prayer for Gomorrah or Sodom. But they're kind of hand in hand.
Right.
Long story short, which is like Christ's priestly prayer, right? Well, my ignorance, and this is what I said. I was like, I get what Abraham's getting at, but isn't he kind of praying that God let the wolves in with the sheep by saving these people? Oh man. And what's his Dr. Schmidt, Dave Schmidt, he really let me have it. But man, it's one of those things where, again, you come and you learn here and you're gonna do ignorant things like that. I want to know what Luther would have said if I'd have asked him that question.
That's a good point. Yeah, I think evidently he wouldn't have been the kind of guy to excoriate you, but like, help you kind of move on to the next point. I mean, I do think that one thing that's special about a place like this, and again, it's true of other places where everybody's sort of unified around a single topic, but the chances of you finding someone here that is would really become a deep friend, because you're already here. Everybody's coming with different reasons, but there's a whole lot of commonality about why you're here and what you're interested in. And again, Lewis talks about friendship as every once in a while you'll meet someone who has an inkling. Here you have that idea of the Inklings, has an inkling of what you feel when you see this thing or read this thing or look at this thing, a real kind of soul connection, right? And if they know, the other person looks at you and doesn't have a clue of what makes you interested in learning Klingon or whatever, but then the other person just thinks this is the best thing in the world. And that's a beautiful moment when you can find someone like that. And there are a lot of people that find at least some level of this in the ministry. I mean, we call each other. I told my family this, and I've been doing this for a long time, and this is the first time they realize that this goes on. We call each other brothers all the time.
Oh, yeah.
Like, like faculty call each other brothers. They refer to, because they, I don't know how it came up. They said, well, do you refer to each other as Dr. So-and-so? Or, and we're like, well, no, we usually just actually call each other brothers, or Brother Herman, or Brother Haupt, or Brother Micah, come over here. And yep. So, and but the thing is, the seminarians refer to themselves that way too. My brothers, yep. Our brothers. Mm-hmm. And then when you get out in the field, the pastoral, you know, the Germans called them Amtbrüder, right? The brothers of the office. And they refer to each other as brothers. And it's not, and of course, that has deep biblical New Testament connotations to talk about one's fellowship in Jesus as a family. But I think that's something that's an important experience that you have here. It's not just a word. It's actually something that actually exhibits our relationship. I don't know if faculty in a state school refer to each other as brothers, but that's is the most common thing in the world. My family was surprised. They thought we were weird. And they were right.
And we are.
Yeah. And we are.
Well, and that even kind of to study the way we do it and to, yeah, just to do what we do, you got to be a little weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Right. And that extends even from a professor to student, right? So there's this this brotherhood going on as students are coming in, or siblings, because we know that there might be prospective deaconesses that are listening in too, right? So
sure.
This brother and sister in Christ thing is it extends between people who are teaching classes and who are taking classes. So I'm in a little bit after this, I have to go and have a beer with a student. That's an awesome thing to do, right? I have to. It's put tough, it on man. My schedule as this grueling part of my work. I love my job, right? To just be able to sit on my back porch with a student and have a beer. And I don't even know what the agenda is going to be, but we're just going to sit out and the conversation will meander and we'll check up on classes. And I'm sure he's got a few things on his agenda. And it's just a delightful moment to be able to enjoy that with a student in a way that maybe in some places, I know that there's affection between teachers and students everywhere, but I think especially at a place like this, it's a smaller school. We all know each other by name, and you have that kind of family feel among everybody.
Yeah, I like to make the age distinction when I'm talking to old faculty member. I meet with Jeff Gibbs quite a bit, and I make sure to call you all big bro, just so you know that I'm a little bit younger than you. Yeah. I said it.
That's good.
To Tim Seleska once, he was like, "Oh, I'm getting a little older than your big bro." I was like, "But it's the sentiment, big bro."
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, after all, our Dale Meyer, who is now our retired president, referred to himself as Opa, which is grandpa. So there's that sense here for sure. I think that's right, and that's important. It's important moving forward with some of the great, not only ideas that one is studying, but the important tasks that we're preparing ourselves for, to have that kind of feel.
So you're bringing history alive and kind of helping us to, on the one hand, go back to these sources and read them with new eyes, point out new things that have existed in Luther's writings, but maybe people have glossed over them or winced at them. And there's something especially I think fun in historical theology. So it sounds Eric, like studying historical theology is not just learning memorizing dates of when things happen, but it's sort of history come to life, and especially how this impacts our faith. So would you say maybe just a little bit about what it's like to study history, and then maybe close us out with any last thoughts?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, first of all, you're right. It's it is not, learning names and dates is, you don't, I mean, we have Wikipedia. You don't even need to do that anymore, right? I mean, it's if only I had all the world's knowledge of facts in a little pocket or something. Oh, wait, I do. It's this. And so, you know, but that was never really the important part about history. History is about studying people, right? The difference between an event happening in a past and the event happening in which someone's involved in it, person, motivations, politics, is the personal aspect of it. Is we're talking about the behaviors in, of human beings. So that, first of all, changes the whole subject matter. And then secondly, because we're interested in church history or the history of theology, we're interested in the what's making people tick. How do these ideas, you got to understand them in their own context. You got to understand why people say what they say before you can really start judging what they're saying. And training people to listen, right? I mean, albeit to people who are largely dead, but you still need to listen. First of all, it's an incredibly important pastoral skill. We too quickly come to judgments about people based on where they're from, who they associate with, et cetera. Well, that's history in spades. I mean, you have to sit there and listen to someone who's you know, 500, 1500 years ago, writing in a different language. And the one common point is they have something to say about Jesus and that they think what they have to say is really important. And it very well may be. And so, yeah, that's our focus, is to help people listen and ask the right kinds of questions. And maybe at the end of the day, become a responsible student of, as Luther says, these dead masters we call books, these voiceless masters, and yet we can still learn from them. So yeah, a lot of books, of course, but the goal is, again, to get a sense that, and what's, it's encouraging. It's actually very encouraging to know that when you're trying to proclaim the gospel or interpret the scriptures, that you're not the first person to have done this. And it's humbling for the exact same reason, right? You're not the first person to have done this. And so slow down, hotshot, and let's maybe listen to a couple other people.
Once again, I thought I was original. I came back from Cambridge full of wisdom, and I had a dissertation idea, and I said it to Jeff Kloa, and it was like, oh man, the Genesis is talking about the incarnation of Jesus when it says, let us make man in our image and likeness. And Irenaeus said this 2,000 years ago. I'm not original at all.
Yeah.
which again is humbling and it's comforting that, you know, other Christians were thinking this way. But man, I had to think about something else if I wanted to pursue a PhD. Kind of a bummer.
Well, that's right. You can laugh about it now, though, right?
Exactly.
Or you can study what Irenaeus had to say. And that's the fascinating thing, is that, you know, these people that have talked about the Bible, what they bring out or what they've taught is fascinating in and of itself. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, excellent.
Yeah. Well, I thought I'd close out maybe just with one kind of final quote. I don't know if you guys remember, and I think Micah, I closed out with this in the presentation I gave not too long ago, but that famous painting about the laughing Jesus, mm-hmm. You know, it was like painted in the 70s or something like that. Okay, it's not my favorite painting by any stretch of the imagination, but it's I did a little reading on it, and it's interesting. First of all, that's not the name of the painting. It's not called The Laughing Jesus. It's called Christ the Liberator. And it was done by a Canadian artist named Willis Wheatley. And he was commissioned to do a couple of different sketches. And this became kind of the most famous one. And so one of the pastors in this Canadian church reflected on it. And I'm just going to share his kind of final reflections on this. Is Gary Patterson. And he says that 3 or 4 decades ago, the United Church commissioned a Canadian artist, Willis Wheatley, to do 4 sketches of Jesus. And the one that I remember best was called Christ the Liberator, a drawing of Jesus with head thrown back, mouth open, a face full of laughter, a laughing Jesus. as he announced the good news of God's love and invited everyone to experience the kingdom of God, that was breaking into their midst. Sure, like Sarah, Jesus recognized the wild incongruity between his vision. Now, who's Sarah? We're talking about Sarah's, is Abraham's wife, if you remember when she heard that she was supposed to have a child, laughed, right? And so Patterson goes on, he says, you know, Jesus is like Sarah. He recognizes the wild incongruity between his vision, this holy promise, and then the reality that surrounded him with Roman oppression and economic hard times and religious authorities investing far too much of their energy on maintaining the status quo, and a bunch of thick-headed disciples who never really seemed to catch the dream. But Jesus laughed, trusting that nothing was impossible for God. And that laughter, though, was deeply challenged by the reality of the crucifixion. This is not a sentimental Pollyanna story, a tale of easy triumphalism. Just as Sarah had her questions, after I have grown old and withered, will I now know pleasure? So did Jesus have his as he hung on the cross. My God, why have you forsaken me? It would seem as if the system had indeed closed in upon itself with death, marking the end of all the hope Jesus had been talking about. Where was the promise now when you really need it? But God was once again doing a new thing, and we call it resurrection. And although we may not fully understand how and when it happens or what it looks like, we trust God in faith, and surely it must be in faith, so that like Sarah, we will be able to say, God has brought laughter for me.
Nice.
Yeah, so there it is. Enjoy the life that God has given you, because he is risen. He's risen indeed.
Hallelujah.
Well, Eric, we certainly appreciate your time. We appreciate you bringing some humor and laughter to Under the Fig Tree. I think we have laughs every once in a while, but certainly not like today. So we certainly appreciate it. And to our listeners, we're gonna edit that part out.
Yeah, I have all kinds of those. Micah rarely has a whiff, but yeah, I always have something. So, but we never get around to editing them out. So, listeners, be listening for these things that we should be editing out.
The blooper reel is deep.
Yeah, I'm all tongue-tied now. Well, anyway, this has been another episode of Under the Fig Tree. Thank you for listening.
Very good. Hey, thanks, guys. This was fun.
All right, we appreciate it. And like we've told most of our guests, especially since you're on faculty, I hope you'll be willing to join us again.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Under the Fig Tree. Throughout the Gospels, Jesus shows his followers how to care for his people. Oftentimes, this includes sharing the word in intimate moments of personal conversation like the Samaritan woman at the well. At other times, it's sharing the word with crowds like the Sermon on the Mount. Sometimes it's just being there for people when they are experiencing the worst moments of life, like when Jesus was there for Jairus when his daughter died.
It's gathering his disciples around a table of bread and wine to hear, "This is my body, this is my blood." Whether it's as a deaconess sharing the word with the sick, or as a pastor preaching the word and administering the sacraments, being there for people at these intimate moments in life is something that Jesus is calling many more people to do. In Under the Fig Tree, we want to bring you into these moments with us, and maybe you begin to see yourself in one of these roles or feel yourself being called into service of the church. If you want to find out more about what it means to be a pastor or deaconess, visit us at csl.edu. And of course, keep listening to Under the Fig Tree.